and welcome to the Money Nerds Podcast, where owning a calculator, budgeting your money, and having a net worth is actually cool. I'm your host, Whitney Hansen, and each week I'll be chatting with inspiring people to learn their secrets to financial success. Now let's dive into the show. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode. Today we're going to talk about sales. And sales is like that dirty word that nobody likes to talk about, but truly, we are all in sales in some capacity. So before you run away from this episode saying, I will never be in sales, that's not me, I'm not scammy, I hope you take the time to listen to this episode all the way through, because I think it'll start to change your mind on what sales actually is and how we can use this amazing, amazing skill set to better your own financial life. I think it's really key. Before we dive into all of the goodness of the episode, I have to share a really great money win, which comes from one of my good friends, Chad. So Chad said, I did it. I found a new job with better benefits and a 42% pay increase. Thanks to Whitney and the FIRE community, I have continued to better myself and my career. Thanks to the group, hashtag money win. Chad, I am so proud of you. This has been a long time coming and very, very well deserved. And honestly, I mean, not to like get us off topic, but it comes back to sales. How do you sell yourself? How do you actually position yourself in the marketplace where you're paid what you deserve? So congratulations to you. I know it's been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to see what that means for your financial life and how you can actually achieve financial independence even more quickly now because of that raise. So congrats again, my friend. Very well deserved. Guys, if you want to join in the Manager Money Like a Boss Facebook group, that's where I hang out. That's where Chad hangs out. A lot of us are in there just communicating, talking, sharing some money wins, and asking questions, because money isn't always so clear cut. And sometimes you just want a different perspective and different opinions. So that's the place to go. Manage your money like a boss. Connect with fellow money nerds. It's a great time. I hang out in there a lot, so you can get your questions answered directly from me. Okay, so I have to share some good news as well. Next week is officially episode 100. This does not include the 5 Tip Fridays, but this is 100 interviews so far. I cannot believe it. That is so crazy. So next week, I'm going to be sharing with you guys a really fun recap of all of the things that I've learned over interviewing 100 rock stars about their finances. So it's going to be kind of a compilation, I think that's the right word. So it's going to be a little bit of a recap on everything that I've learned so far and distilling down 100 episodes of guests and just amazingness. So I'm super excited about that. Just wanted to let you know to put that on your radar for next week. All right, let's dive into today's content. Ricky Newton is a sales professional in Silicon Valley tech industry, and he's also the host of the rockstar podcast, The Wealthy Healthy Podcast. I love his show. It's really, really good. After doubling his income in the first 15 months of his career, he became considerably more interested in understanding how to invest and save surplus earnings responsibly on the road to financial independence. He holds a degree in psychobiology, human physiology, and a communications emphasis, and is a regional champion and state medalist in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, all of which has helped him inspire his interest in health and fitness. As a professional, Ricky has closed over $4 million in advertising revenue and was even named the 2017 Next Big Rising Star by San Francisco Bay Area Innovation Group. So he's pretty much a total badass, and I love everything that he's up to. In this episode, we talk about sales tactics to become aware of, why introverts can do great in a sales setting, his favorite strategies, book recommendations to help us be better at persuasion, salary negotiation, and what to do when they ask you that dreaded question, how much do you expect to make? I hate that question. So there's actually a strategy behind that. And we talk about how do you approach that in a very tactful way and not sabotage your chances of getting a better starting salary. And then, of course, because we're talking about sales and persuasion and negotiation, we have to talk about car negotiation tips. So if you're in the market for a car towards the end of the episode, you're going to get all the good content on how you can approach this and use it to your advantage. Guys, I am so excited to introduce you to my new friend, Ricky Newton from thewealthyhealthy.com. All right, guys, welcome back to another episode. Today, I am joined by one of my Instagram friends and fellow podcasters, Ricky Newton from The Wealthy Healthy Podcast. Ricky, it's an honor, my friend. Thank you so much for hanging out.
Thank you. This is actually the first time I'm on the other side of the microphone. So yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm excited.
It's always so awkward. You're like, oh wait, I'm being interviewed now. I have to talk. What is it?
Yeah, it's different. It's a different type of sort of a different mindset.
It is a different mindset. Yeah. I remember when I first started doing interviews on the flip side, I was hella nervous and I'm not bad now. But at first I remember thinking, oh my gosh, am I going to say the wrong thing? And blah, blah, blah. It's so ridiculous. The mindset stuff for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm never nervous to host, but I'm definitely a little bit nervous right now, which is like a new, yeah, that's a new thing.
We'll power through it. Yeah. We'll power through it. It'll be great. So speaking of podcasts, tell us a little bit about your podcast. How long have you been doing it? What was the goal and what was the intention behind it?
Yeah. So, The Wealthy Healthy is basically the idea of it was like, I just wanted to do a podcast. I loved the medium and I didn't really know what I was actually qualified to talk about. So I made the sort of pro and con sort of double-edged sword decision of making sort of a broad themed podcast. So in essence, what we do is we are dedicated to inspiring better mental, physical, and financial health. And we're doing that through either solo episodes where I'm talking about maybe one episode is a couple of affirmations to overcome anxiety. And then the next one might be literally like, what's the difference between a 401k and a Roth IRA? And then we'll have guests on from all kinds of different walks of life. We've had CEOs and best-selling authors, and then literally just my friends who I've worked with before and have a really interesting story. So it's been an awesome experience, and it's had good reception. So I mean, that's the exciting thing. Every episode, the goal for me is just if one person listens to it and gets something out of it that they can kind of take away and remember or use, then that episode was successful.
I love that. So what was your inspiration behind? You mentioned you liked the podcast. It was a medium you were familiar and you enjoyed, but why start your own, man? It's a lot of work.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm kind of a compulsive projects. Like I almost get made fun of like for having hobbies, which isn't to say that like having a hobby is a thing to make fun of, but I have a bunch of them and most of them I've been doing for a while. So it's not necessarily like I'll start one and drop it. But in the case of the podcast, it was just, I felt like I wanted to create in that way. I had sort of a void left. I got injured, so I stopped competing in martial arts. So I kind of felt like I had this 2 hour a day void of like, what do I do with this time that I normally used to train and obsess over martial arts and wasn't able to do that anymore. So the thing that kind of inspired it was actually after I had graduated from college and started working and I really made my first real paycheck, particularly a sales commission check, that was sort of the catalyst for me looking at my money and going like, oh, I have really sort of no idea what to do with this. Like I've always been a saver, but I'm not really sure where to put this or how to make it grow or how much I need to save as an emergency fund or anything like that. Didn't really have too much knowledge. So I started investigating that. And as I learned more, people would just come to me for questions on this as if I were a financial planner. And I always had to tell people like, dude, I'm not a professional, but I can tell you like what I would do. And it got to the point where I had so many friends and colleagues who would actually like refer me other people to me for questions about little minutia about a 401k or whatever it is, ESPP stock options, like random little things. And I was kind of like, okay, well, if there's this need, if there's not enough of like this millennial voice out there, I'm not the only person that's doing this necessarily by any means, but I could sort of repurpose ideas that are my own and ideas that have been inspired by other people and just give it a different voice for a different audience. And once I put that out there, I'd been planning the podcast for months. I put it out there with my friend Steve and he was like, dude, I would love to do the audio aspect. He's a web designer and audio engineer. So that was the part that I was sort of dreading having to do. So I kind of hand off all the files to him and I just make the content and talk to people. And that's been, yeah, a really fun project.
Wow. Well, in other notes, I'm looking for a partner right now, everybody listening in. I need the audio engineer part. That's what's going on. That's amazing. I like that.
Yeah, there's a bottleneck. If you let everything like, yeah, it's tough. It's really tough to source. People don't, I think if you don't host a podcast, you don't totally appreciate the full scope of what goes into making it successful and preparing well for an interview and writing. Like if you're going to write about money, you better be right. You know, like I can't, yeah. I can't put out false information about a 72T early withdrawal from a retirement account. Like I can't get that wrong. I better do a lot of reading. I mean, it takes hours for every episode to get it right. And if you're going to also do your own editing and your own social media management and your own sourcing, I mean, that's add an hour or two per each of those things per episode. And yeah, that's it's been great to have him as a partner.
No doubt. Well, it sounds like you're a really diligent person. You really do your homework before you go into any situation. So did that help you in your career? So if I understand correctly, you've closed or helped close over $5 million in sales for companies, your own companies that you've been working for. That's impressive. Did that diligence transfer over to help you become a better salesperson?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I would say that it definitely has. I mean, I can, there's diligence and then there's things that I would attribute just to luck. I mean, I grew up largely in the San Francisco Bay Area and it is high cost of living, but at the same time, I grew up in like the Silicon Valley house. So we were very, very middle class and education was very much a focus, but I just feel lucky in that I was very exposed to those things. And so it sort of wasn't a question to me that like, it wasn't always on the table that I could eventually just go work in tech. And now I didn't know I was going to do sales necessarily, but I always feel like there's a lot of things that were just sort of I was dealt good hands in a lot of ways. I mean, just the year that I graduated into it not being a recession was even a factor in the success that I've been able to have, if you want to call it that, in the first couple of years of my career. But yeah, to your question more specifically, yeah, I consider myself a student of sales. And that's one of the things I talk about a lot when I have friends who are thinking about a sales career, is that it's not really a job as much as it is a career. And the distinction there is like there's a lot of paths that you can take where you can come in at 9, leave at 5 and really leave the work at the office. And on the weekends, you can kind of shut it down and you don't have to learn too much in terms of like the skill. You can kind of learn on the job and kind of clock in, clock out, and it's comfortable. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're in sales, you're sort of always thinking about it in a way. And it is sort of zero sum. Like you have to either, you're either going to win or you're not. And so because of that, you have to, I think that if you want to do well at it, you have to be very diligent and you have to be a student of the game. So I do a lot of reading. I mean, I guess through Audible. So if you're a reading purist and you don't think that that's reading, then I do a lot of listening, but I'm still consuming information about sales is sort of the point. Listen to a lot of podcasts, listen to a lot of audiobooks and read a lot of articles about sales and sales techniques and things like that. And I think that that's helped. And then sort of also it's not very different from like interviewing on a podcast. There's preparation that you can do your homework before you go into an interview for a podcast. You should, if you want it to go well. Right. And a sales pitch is the same way. It's generally going to go better if you've done a little bit of homework. And even if that means looking at somebody's LinkedIn profile and saying, hey, I saw that you play guitar. If that's the first thing that you open with, you're like, I also play guitar. You're like, okay, now right away we don't have to spend a lot of time on that. Let's not waste 10 minutes talking about guitar. But if we want to do a 60 seconds, like, hey, I'm a human being, you're a human being, we have a similar thing here. I'm not just coming in here to be some cold calculating salesperson. Like we're both people. Those kinds of things can even be helpful as well. And that's helpful in any context, like in a dating context, in an interviewing context, even outside of sales.
Totally. Totally. How long have you been officially in sales as your job title?
Well, I guess about 4 years, if you count a little bit of time that I spent in school, working part-time when I was a senior, I sold ad space for like an apartment listing in Davis. Nice. But yeah, I mean, really like professional tech sales for a little over 3 years.
That's amazing. So has your perception changed from what you initially thought sales was to what you believe it is today?
Yeah, it has a little bit. I think I pick up what you're putting down with that question. being on the other side, it's interesting to see your setup. So I appreciate it. Yeah, it has. I mean, going in, I didn't know if I wanted to do sales. I didn't necessarily think of sales as like the sharky I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it being that used car salesman sort of vibe where this person will just say yes to anything and lie to you till the ends of the earth just to get the deal from you. And I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be like that, but I think I expected a little bit of that. What surprised me going into it that I wasn't necessarily expecting initially was that so much of it is about driving value that actually as a salesperson, it isn't about just peddling the product. Ideally, very much ideally. And in my case, it's a non-starter. Like I have to be passionate about what I'm selling and believe in it because it's so much easier than to get behind it. It's a different thing to be like, oh, I'm going to sell the third best solution in the space. Like that's, that's a bit more of a hill to overcome. You may have to be a little bit more dishonest at times in order to succeed selling the third best solution or the third best product or whatever it is. And in this case, like if you're aligned with what you're selling, it's all about the value that you can create and the problems that you can solve. And I didn't quite see it that way when I was first starting. And it's definitely very clearly, if you want to succeed in sales in the modern day, particularly when we're talking about professional tech sales, that is what sales is by definition. It's about driving value and building trust and creating partnerships.
That's so interesting. So true story. I was sitting through an MBA class one time, and I think it was marketing, kind of irrelevant, but it was like a marketing class with a bunch of people that were all over the board with careers. Some were very established professionals. Some were just barely starting out in their careers and were the full-time student kind of life. And the professor asked us a question. He said, "Hey, how many of you guys actually want to go into sales as a career?" And I looked around the room, Ricky, there was probably like maybe 100 students. There were two hands that went up in the air.
Huh.
And that was so fascinating to me. So that makes me kind of wonder, have you always wanted to go into sales? I mean, your background's in psychobiology and human physiology. So that's very interesting. So how did you end up in sales and what made you decide to stick it out?
Yeah. If I were in that class, I probably would not have raised my hand at that time. And yeah, that's an interesting thing. I think a lot of people with a lot of professions, they sort of fall into them. And I think sales, not always, but very often is something that people sort of fall into. And so to answer your question, like how I ended up doing sales, and specifically, I mean, I've been mostly in the advertising space, which is also not really related at all to what I studied. And I thought in school that I might be a bioethics lawyer. I really liked science, and I thought, well, you know, lawyers make a lot of money and I feel like I could be cut out for it. So I'll do that. And then as I was going through undergrad, I was like, I would really love not to do several more years of school, really expensive school, take these really hard tests. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's kind of stopped. I stopped feeling passionate about the idea of going into law. And as I was thinking about it, I was like, okay, well, you know, my dad's a marketer. I grew up with sort of this example, like I said, of this Silicon Valley house of this marketer in a technology company. My whole life pretty much is that's what he's been doing. And so I looked at that and I was like, well, marketing seems fun and I could probably get with that. And as I was looking for jobs, I started looking for jobs 7 months before I graduated my senior year, knowing that there were companies that would hire for new grad classes that were happening in the summer. So I was graduating in June and I started applying to full-time work the October prior or the September prior. And I really wanted to get something lined up. And I was looking at marketing jobs and I was looking at these companies. I was kind of like, I don't really care where I go, but I would love to be in biology and tech and biotech or something, you know, something like that. I kind of wanted to be a part of that sort of movement forward of advancing health and health related technology. And at the time, this was 2015, biotech companies and products were all still in clinical trial phases. There was nothing to market or sell. There was no product. You had to be pipetting stuff in a lab coat, and I wasn't going to do that. So I thought, okay, well, then I'll just do marketing and sales wherever I go. It doesn't matter. As long as it's a cool company, cool technology, it's in the Bay Area, I think I could be happy with that, and I could get with it. And if I hate it, I could leave after a year. And I was looking at these marketing jobs, and it's like every company has maybe one opening for a marketing coordinator, and they'll pay you $33,000, and 50 people applied. Everyone wants to do it, and they can basically pay as little as possible because it's so in demand and they only need one entry-level marketing person. And when I was looking at, okay, well, I thought of sales and marketing as being somewhat closely related. So I started looking at sales jobs, and out the gate, they pay at least twice as much. And every company would hire four salespeople at the same time, entry-level salespeople, brand new out of school. They might do a class of, you know, three or six or whatever hires. In my case, it was four. So I was like, well, this seems like a better jumping off point. Like if I'm going to give something a shot in working at someone else's company and I'm going to be a part of that sort of corporate machine and I want to be on the commercial side rather than the technical side. I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to be a lab coat scientist. So I kind of was left with sales. I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. I don't really know much about it. I actually, when I showed up for my first day of my first full-time sales job, I had misunderstood exactly what I was going to do. All I was doing was cold calling and cold emailing to set meetings. I thought I would also have to pitch. So I was like, oh, I thought I actually had to sell. All I have to do is set, like, I get paid and gold. on just setting the meeting, and then I hand it off to somebody else and they do the pitch and they try to close the deal. Like, I just get paid on setting it. And they're like, yeah, that's what you do. I was like, I didn't even know that.
You're like, oh, cool.
So, I was like, sweet. That sounds easy, honestly. And as long as it's not soul crushing for me, it would be easy. And,
no doubt.
And that just sort of, that happened to work out. But I mean, at its core, I fell into it. I didn't know until a couple months into that I would at all actually enjoy sales as a long-term career path.
Oh, I think that's such a cool conversation to have, because if I always joke that if my business totally fails and I absolutely go bankrupt overnight and I have to start over, I would probably be in sales as well. I think it's a really cool opportunity. And I think you get to learn a lot about people. And if you're a people person, even if you're not really a people person, you just learn so much. And one of the things that I know you know a ton about is sales strategies. So can we dig into some of these things? So everyone listening is like, yes, I want to be better at sales and maybe be more persuasive. What are some of your favorite quote unquote strategies?
Yeah. Oh man, there's so many things that we could talk about. Also, to your point, before we talk about that, I do want to mention, and we'll probably end up doubling back to things like misconceptions. You don't have to be a people person. It certainly can help. And most salespeople are, and it's not that I'm not a people person, but I identify as an introvert. I get my energy from myself and my projects and, being one-on-one, and I do very well in one-on-one sales conversations because of that. But like going to a networking event or being in a room where 15 people are looking at me, I can get stoked up for that. And then when I go home, it's like, don't talk. Like, I want to work from home the next day. Like, I need space after that. So that can work though, because I think introverts make good listeners. So that's a whole separate thing, but you're absolutely right on that.
I like that. So you said you do have quite a few favorite strategies.
Yeah, so many strategies.
Let's dive into some of these.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of things about, like, if you want to think about sales strategy, sometimes people are going to think about the manipulative used car salesy sort of stuff where they're planting ideas in your head of like, you're not a Nissan driver, you're a Cadillac driver. And like those things sort of work, but they're also slimy. And I don't personally use anything like that. And whether interpersonally or professionally, whether you're doing sales as your job or not, you can get better at sales. They are developed skills. And I think some of them are very, very granular. It would be super boring to talk about. Some of the larger ones, one of my favorite ones and the one that I definitely want to lead with is that, like you said about like human nature, understanding more about people. Human beings love stories. Like, that doesn't require any sort of education to understand. Humans love stories. And like storytelling as a history, that's a distinctly human quality. We've done it probably. I mean, there's like cave paintings. You could go, I mean, however far back humans have been telling each other stories. And I think in 2018, if you're navigating social situations and professional situations and you're not using stories deliberately, to me, that's one of the biggest missed opportunities that you absolutely can fix. It's a skill, just like most things. Some people you might feel like that person is just a natural born charismatic storyteller. I'm not that person. I was super nervous to pick up the phone I was the guy who was nervous senior in high school, senior in college. I would have been nervous to order a pizza over the phone. So sales was not an obvious career path for me. It wasn't something I learned how to do these things. And I think anyone can. And so it's not enough, obviously, to just tell stories. Like, you want to develop the skills around what makes a good storyteller, what the elements are of a good story. I mean, everyone has known that person. Maybe it's a colleague in the office. They walk up to you. They start telling you something about themselves for no reason. They just walk up and start talking about themselves, and then they pause, and you're sitting there waiting for more, and then they're like, that's the end of the story. You didn't even really, you're just sitting there. You're like, oh, that was the whole story. Okay, that was the whole story. And you're like, what do you even say? You don't even know what to say. And like, that's terrible storytelling. I mean, even me giving that example, people listening are probably like, oh, like either I hope I'm not that person, or I know that person and that I avoid that person like the plague. And to be the exact opposite, to be a very good storyteller, is extremely powerful. And so for me, one of the books that changed, I get a lot from books. And one of the books that changed the way that I think about stories is Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller. It's a short read. It works in audiobook format. So if you're an audiobook person, this isn't one where you're going to miss out on a ton if you listen to it in audio instead of hard copy. Building a Story Brand fundamentally like changed the way I think about what makes a good story. They have this sort of 7-part framework, and it's probably my most recommended book at this point. I tell everyone to read it if they're going to be doing anything sales or sales related. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're in recruiting, if you're in marketing, if you're going to go to an interview and you want to sell yourself, like, understanding how to tell a good story is super, super key. So that's a great one. And then the second book, I would also recommend Sell with a Story by Paul Smith. That's more for salespeople. It's very like, he really breaks out what kinds of stories you have to have, these sales stories. And that's more dense. I would highly recommend getting that in a physical copy rather than audiobook. I did audiobook first, and it's a little bit hard to follow in that format because there's a lot of sort of interactivity with the book where you're going to want to be able to annotate and write things down and bookmark things. So that's another great one though. And that basically talks about like what kinds of stories you want to have as examples to tell potential clients or prospects to illustrate a point. Maybe it's another client who had a similar problem to them, and it's a story about how you and your solution fixed it. Those kinds of things, having those in your back pocket ready to roll is super, super valuable, especially if you're going to be in a professional sales context, but really for anybody. So I think storytelling is my first one. I know that's like a long-winded answer, so
it's perfect.
Take a step back before jumping any further.
I like it. Well, so I like that you're focusing on storytelling, because when we hear storytelling, we don't immediately go, oh, ding, 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 this is sales. But I don't know about you, but I strongly believe we are all in sales, whether we like it or not. And maybe you can call it something else, but all we're doing is just trying to persuade somebody. So maybe it's trying to get your voice heard at the meeting that you never get to pitch in at, or maybe it's closing that deal. Maybe it's starting your business. It's whatever the heck it is. It's getting your kids to listen to you and pick up all their stuff. I mean, we are all in sales. So these two books that you're recommending, do you feel like that would be helpful for the average person as well?
Building a story brand would be sell with a story a little less so. If you're just thinking about it as like, I do need to understand some sales skills for the day to day, sell with a story is going to be way too dense for you. Building a story brand is super accessible. Highly recommend that for anybody. If you're an engineer, I don't care. Like, you read that Building a Story Brand book over Sell with a Story in that case.
I love it. This is awesome. Okay, so storytelling is your first favorite strategy. What are some of your other faves?
So I mentioned upfront like details being really key, and I don't want to drown everyone with a bunch of details, but I do want to use one example that I like to think of all the time. And I tell this to people all the time. The words that you choose are super, you can very strategically choose the types of words that you say, particularly when you're asking questions, or making requests. So, and you should definitely, that in and of itself, asking questions is a sales strategy and a skill. Asking good questions, that's a whole separate thing, but the way that you ask questions, the way that you phrase questions can make a huge difference to how somebody perceives it. And you definitely want to be deliberate about how you're asking those questions. So the example that I like is, let's say you're talking to somebody about their profession and you want to understand how they came to doing that line, how they ended up in that line of work. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of two ways that you could ask a question like that. And one of them is, why did you choose that line of work? And the other one is, what made you choose that line of work? Those are basically the same question, but the phrasing in the first one, why did you choose that line of work, I think has like a 70% higher chance of being misconstrued as judgmental or negative. Totally. Like, why did you choose that? Why would you want to do that? Like, people could read it that way, even if you didn't mean it that way. Whereas phrasing it the exact same question, saying, what made you choose that line of work, it's almost impossible to take that as offensive. So I think of questions like that. The openers are openers, like whether you use the word why or if or are or do or what, like those openers, I've done an entire podcast episode, I think, on just that topic, because it's that important. But yeah, that's definitely another one where I'm very, very deliberate. And again, I try to be sort of studious, and I'll even like A/B tests and emails and stuff like, does asking for time this way do better than this? And once I was kind of back in the dating scene again, I found how valuable it was to understand that just for dating. So just like you said, like, even if you're not in professional sales, you are in the business of selling something, yourself, your ideas, whatever it is. And being able to ask questions in a way that it's really clear and you're not going to offend anybody accidentally is super valuable and something that is worth paying attention to. So I think of that as a sales strategy, because I spend a lot of time actually thinking about it and being strategic about what words I do or don't use.
I love this. So one of the things that immediately comes to my mind too, as you're sharing some of the tactics and strategies we can start using, is the shorter meeting. So maybe you've reached out to somebody that you want to mentor you, or you think is like just a really cool person, and you've got 20 minutes with this person. How would you approach it? Would you be very like open-ended with your questions, or would you kind of try to get to the point? So if we don't have a lot of time, what do we do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a tendency to ask questions that go like, they're very start to finish on the timeline. I don't know how to describe that. Like as an example, let's say I'm talking to a CEO or a mentor, if I have the opportunity to talk to Tim Ferriss or Tom Bilyeu or somebody like that, that I definitely look up to, then if I really only have 20 minutes, I would probably ask some narrower specific questions first so that I can make sure I get those out. Because I think those are the ones that are kind of like, if you were in this situation, how would you approach this? And then they can give me like a 2-line answer and I can move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. But I would definitely have some sort of broad stroke questions. If I think about like, if I'm talking to a C-level executive or something like that, let's say I'm in an interview context, I want to understand what was the vision when you started the company and how has it changed since then? Or if it's changed at all, then how has it changed? Or what is the hypothesis for this project, for this company? Like, are you imagining that XYZ changes this much? Is it going to change naturally? Is it already changing? Is the space already changing? Or is the change going to be brought on by platforms like yours and people will adapt to that? Like what's the product market fit? What was the idea? What was the vision? Those kind of broad stroke questions, very generally speaking, people can't answer those questions in under 5 minutes unless they just hate talking or they're super bored with you for some reason. So, if I had 20 minutes, I would probably pick 2 questions like that to take up the back half of the conversation. And I would come up with like 10 spitfire 60-second answerable type questions. If I had to structure it, that's probably how I would do it.
That's so interesting. And I love this too, because you mentioned you're introverted. So when people hear introverted and they're like, oh God, I don't want to have to sit there and talk for 20 minutes. You don't freaking have to. All you have to do is ask good questions and let them do all the talking. And then they walk away feeling like you are the coolest person in the world. And you just potentially got yourself a mentor or a job or whatever it might be. So I think that really good advice, my friend. This is really interesting stuff.
Yeah, no, 100%. That's right on the money. I mean, literally, if I were to talk about a third and final sales strategy, I would say ask thoughtful questions because that exactly to your point, you don't even have to talk. And that just, it allows other people to understand how deeply you're thinking about them and their problem or their ideas. And that says a lot about you to even have thought of the question. You don't have to explain like, I'm a thoughtful person. You never have to say that if you just ask thoughtful questions.
I think it's such a fun conversation. I'm really having a great time with this too. And I'm hoping that we can maybe hit somewhere that people are currently experiencing. So I've got some entrepreneurs that listen in, but most are just, you know, normal people working 9 to 5 and trying to make a little bit more money in their career. So let's talk about that dreaded salary negotiation when you go to sell, why you're worth more than they maybe want to pay.
Yeah. You did an episode on this. You did like a 5-Tip Friday on this,
I did,
right?
Yeah.
So I see. I can't not do my own homework too, even if I'm going to be undecided to my own homework. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So I mean, that's great advice as well. So for people listening, obviously, I would imagine that people who listen to you like almost everything that you have to say. So those were good tips as well, and I would definitely echo a number of those sentiments. There were some things that weren't touched on in that format, so I'm happy to kind of speak to those. So the way that I think about negotiating a raise, or if you're going in for an interview and you're going to negotiate the salary, so one of the first things is like, you never want to name the price up front. And that I think is a little counterintuitive to some people, because technically right now, I don't know if this is state by state, but in the US and certainly in California, recruiters actually can't ask you how much you make right now, but they'll still find little ways to try, like, how much are you asking for? What do you want out of it? Like, how much would you want to be paid? And if you just go out and go, I want $90,000, like, you don't know if the budget for that was $150,000 and you just put yourself in a weaker position. Like, why are you pricing yourself lower? Why are you, there's so many things that could, that even the price itself could put you just, yeah, this person's cheaper, but maybe there's a reason they believe they're cheaper than what we were budgeting. Maybe they're lower quality. You don't want to set yourself up for any sort of failure like that. So I say never mention the actual number that you're looking for. You mentioned in your episode doing the research, looking at Glassdoor. I obsessively do this. If I'm thinking about this sort of thing, I want to understand what other people are making and at what stage in their career. And to a certain extent, I kind of want to know if I'm ahead or behind, you know, like there's a little bit of an aspect of that. And understanding what that value is, mounting a case for what that value is. In the case of sales, I, like you said, most people listening to this aren't necessarily in professional sales. It's very easy in professional sales because you're held to a quota. So if the company pays you $150,000 in a given year and you closed $1 million of business, then they're making like 1 to 7 on you. You're paying for other people's salary. You're keeping the lights on. And it's really easy to go in and say, look, I beat my quota 3 out of the 4 quarters by a ton of percent. And I closed this much revenue. Like, you guys know that I bring this value and that I, you know, I want to stay here. I'm motivated to do this longer with you guys. And this is what I need in order to continue to be really, really excited about it. This is what I feel like I'm worth. If you've got a manager who's got your back, I was fortunate in my most recent situation where I did the salary negotiation. She didn't even question it. I gave her a range on, so we played the little game of like, she's like, what are you looking for in comp? And I was like, what are you going to give me in comp? And she's like, nope, not doing that. Like, you name it. So I gave her a range. This is a thing that I'll do, is like, I'll give kind of a broad range. And then I will try to get as close to the higher end of that range as possible. And you never, this is another thing about negotiating, you never want to actually meet in the middle. Meeting in the middle is sort of a weak position. It's counterintuitive. It feels like it's fair, but you actually lost if you meet in the middle, even though it feels fair. You lost. You were trying to win more. You're trying to win the negotiation, and you essentially just walked away. It's like a default. Another great book for this, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. He was a former FBI hostage negotiator. So he tells a lot of great stories about really, really, really important negotiations where people's lives actually mattered and how he navigated those situations. And obviously it's in the title of the book, Never Split the Difference. He says like, look, the person who's willing to walk away is the person who's got the power position. The person who's willing to settle in the middle is the person who is willing to lose or is going to lose. So that's another thing I think about, is like, if I'm thinking I want to make 120K ideally, I'm going to go in and tell my manager, I want to make between 115 and 130. And maybe I'll walk away with 125, 130. And that's that sort of thing. As long as you've mounted the case, I've personally seen that's effective. But again, I haven't done this for that long. So that's just kind of, those are things that I've put into practice, that I've seen other people put into practice, and that I've learned from books like Chris Voss's Never Split the Difference.
I like it. Okay. So that's if they're trying to maybe negotiate a new raise or get that first job. So what about in the interview phase when we're just trying to sell ourselves? Do you have any tips on maybe like charisma or how to be more personable during the interview via sales?
Yeah. So definitely do your research on the people and the company. If you're going to talk to 6 people, look at all of their LinkedIn profiles, find a couple things that you want to ask about them, and be super genuine when you be genuine in your interest. It shouldn't be that hard. People are mostly interesting. Like, that's the great thing about humans, is like, it's hard to find a truly boring, substanceless one. Like, people got things going on in their head. They've done things in their lives, experienced things. You probably have something in common. Find those things to latch onto, ask questions about it. I recently saw on somebody's LinkedIn that they pointed out that they dropped out of Wharton Business School. And I was like, why would you call that out? Like, there's a reason they're doing that. So you could even do that, and that shows a genuine interest and that you're the type of person who does dig deeper and has a curiosity. So that's one thing. Definitely use confident language. I think people have a tendency to sort of sell themselves down a little bit, as in a way, in a means of sort of appearing humble. You definitely don't want to come off arrogant. That's probably one of the worst things you can do, is come off super arrogant, like you've got it in the bag already. But you also don't want to be going in there and being like, yeah, you know, like, I don't know if I'm qualified for like those parts. I don't really have those skills, but like, I think I can learn them. Like, don't use words like I think, and I think these are not certain terms. So I would say, again, choose your words carefully, speak in really certain terms, and say, even if you're not qualified for something, say, I don't know that now, but I know that I could learn it. And if I had this opportunity, I would learn as much of it. Like, whatever resources you think I can learn online about this tool or this coding language or whatever it is, what this vertical, if I'm going to be doing sales, the competitors in the space, I will do the research. I will come in with most of that information already ready if I have this opportunity. And having that kind of confident language, confident body language, of course, like sitting open. I'm doing it right now as I'm talking about it. Shoulders back, chest out, good posture. Don't hide yourself. Don't do anything with your hands or your face or your hair that would show that you're overly nervous or insecure. You're trying to hide behind something. Like, just own everything. There's even like all these weird little body language tricks that are almost like psychology hacks, like peeking your fingers, like putting your fingers together in a tent. But that looks very diabolical. You don't want to do that too often, but you can kind of use little things like that. You can mirror their body language. Those are all valuable in an interview context and easily Googled and practiced without having to like have gone through tons and tons of interviews for the practice in real time.
Ooh, I'm glad that you mentioned body language. Can we touch on that too? So I've heard before, I don't know how true this is, but I've heard that body language is equally, if not more important than the words that you say. Do you find that to be true?
I think that depends on the context. I can certainly think of times where that would be true. But at the same time, if you walked into an interview and you said something absolutely crazy, but your body language, or, you know, if you're just like started swearing and like you started taking your clothes off, I mean, guys, that's body language. So if you just started screaming, right? If the word, you just started screaming and you started saying mean racist things to the person that's interviewing, it doesn't matter what your body language is. Sure. So I'm obviously I'm being extreme there, in regards to that question, but yeah, I think body language, those nonverbals, your tone. I think if you want to consider tone part of body language, I would certainly agree with your sort of that thesis there, that body language might be more important than the things that you say. I think something like 70% of communication is in the nonverbals. So things like eye contact and body language. I think that that's certainly the case. And you could say all the right things, but come off very insecure or not confident, or as you, I mean, you could even, your body language could communicate that you're a liar, you know, and sure, people might pick up on that. And you, it doesn't matter if you say all the right things. If somebody thinks that you're a liar, like they're going to say, okay, thanks for the opportunity. And they're not going to call you back. So, I think that, yeah, paying attention to body language is extremely valuable. And if you include tone in that, even more so.
Oh, I love it. It just seals the deal. So you mentioned not being, I guess, scared or intimidated to share some of your humble brags, to really share your accomplishments in a positive way. How do you balance sharing confidence versus coming across as egotistical? Do you have any like tips on how to tread that line?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I feel like I still work on that, because I think what it is there's sort of this phrase that I'm absolutely going to butcher, which is something to the effect of like, confidence. I'm not even gonna get close. It's to the effect, you know, it's to the gist of like, confidence is not spoken and arrogance is, or something like that. Like, arrogance, yes, speaks, confidence walks, or, you know, something to that, uh-huh, something in that vein. And I think that that's generally true, right? If you're going into an interview situation, they have your resume. If you've done your resume well, if you've done your LinkedIn profile well, if you have any sort of reference, like if somebody internal at the company knows you and can speak highly of you, you don't need to talk about your accomplishments. If they ask you, you can talk about them. You can also kind of stop. I think one thing that I do somewhat consciously is I'll stop short of the full story. And that's not necessarily to lie by omission or anything. It's just that I know that if I volunteer the second half of the story, which is the part where I absolutely crushed it and was awesome and like beat everybody or whatever, mm-hmm, that can come off as arrogant. And I, rather than risk that, I might let them ask me the question. So I might walk right up to the line of like, yeah, I did all this and that. And like, I felt like it went really well. I learned a lot. And you just kind of stop there. And like, that's not necessarily a false humility. They might not ask, but they also might be like, okay, well, when you say you did well, like I'm looking at your resume, you exceeded XYZ, you did this and that, and you accomplished this and that thing. Tell me a little bit more about that. And then you can start to kind of go through it as like they prompted it. And it's sort of just, it just becomes a list of facts, as opposed to like, I'm so eager to pat myself on the back. Mm-hmm. You can sort of do that deliberately. Even if you are genuinely eager to pat yourself on the back, hopefully that's not how you're going into an interview situation. But if you are that type of person, be aware of it. And maybe strategically draw back a little bit before that line and let them sort of come to you about it.
That is such a genius tip. I appreciate you sharing that. That's really, yeah, really interesting. I could literally talk about this stuff all day long with you, because I'm so passionate about this too. And I think it's so important for people. But let me ask the million-dollar question here. So when we go to the car dealer and we are going back and forth, are they really going to talk to their manager, or is this a sales tactic?
It can be either. I think car sales is a whole different thing. It's still sales, but it's not the same thing. I just bought a car in September of last year, so I guess almost a year ago. But I kind of thought of it as a game. They were all, every single person I talked to asked me like, what do you do for work? Are you an accountant or are you in sales? I was like, yeah, the latter. I'm in sales. They're like, oh, that's what's happening here. Cause everything that they would do, I'd be like, that's a trick. There are little tricks like that. Yeah. Going back to talk to the manager. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. A lot of the time, like if it's a money thing, if it's like taking the price down on something, there are certain thresholds where they probably do have to go back to the manager and talk about it, because there is a certain point of discounting where they will struggle to break even. There's also a lot of secret ways that, like at a car dealership, secret ways that the dealership is making money. So I had the guy walk me over to the system and goes, dude, look, like, we paid more for this car than you're paying for it now. Like, we're losing money. We're already losing $200 on this car if I sell it to you at this price. I'm like, I don't care. I care what I'm buying the car for. Yeah. And I don't know if you're getting like a $2,000 spiff behind the back, you know, like from GM. I don't know. Like, I don't know what the structure is, all these little secret things. You have to assume that a lot of them are those little secret things, honestly, in a car dealership type of situation, that's a little bit different. In a door-to-door sales type of situation, that's a little different than like a long tail. Like, that person doesn't really care to develop a relationship with you. Like, the trust that you guys build with each other doesn't really pay dividends for them again. Whereas like in a tech context, if somebody trusts you and they value your opinion, they'll come back for it over and over, and you can go to a new company and they'll still be like, that's my guy. He doesn't lie to me and he brings a lot of value to the table. He's like a person on my own team. Whereas like somebody selling you a car, I guess, unless you're probably buying like a Rolls Royce, like something where you might buy another super expensive car later, they're going to play those games with you, and you have to be aware of it and call them on it politely. Be polite, but call them on it.
That's so funny. I just went through the car buying process in January. No, it was the end of December. And it was this similar type of thing where, you know, if you know the game and you kind of understand some of the tactics, I don't have nearly as much experience as you do, but it was quite entertaining just to see, these are some of the strategies they're using on me. And they absolutely did the same thing of, this is the lowest we can possibly go. And at that point, I just ate more free popcorn and said, let's see. So, it is kind of fun, though. If you make it into a game, I think it can be quite entertaining. Ricky, what are some of them? I know we're getting a little close to our time, but what are some of the additional strategies that you see that we would normally approach in an everyday situation?
What do you mean by that? Like the strategies that we would see on the receiving end?
Yeah, maybe just to be aware of.
Yeah. So let's use the car sales example, because that's the one that people dread so much and everyone probably deals with it at some point. And this will sort of apply to any sort of sales content. I mean, I think literally some of these will work in dating and you want to not be the victim of them. So if we're talking about like slightly slimier sales games, the kind of things that they'll do is like, I have someone coming in an hour to talk about this exact car. And you're like, do you really? Like, is someone really coming in an hour? You don't know if that's true necessarily. You kind of just take it at face value, but like, go ahead and let it take longer than an hour. See if that person shows up. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm not in a rush. Mm-hmm. So that's one of those things. People will sort of create an urgency. That's a really common sales tactic, even in professional sales and tech. Like, you have to create some sort of urgency, or else why would anyone take action? Sure. In a professional context, we usually go about that a different way than somebody would in a car buying context, because they're trying to sell you that car that day. Like, if you walk away, the chance that you come back and buy it goes down by a lot. The losing money on it is another one. another thing I think that you can do if you're on the receiving end of a sales situation is, if you have a friend, odds are, like, a lot of people work in sales, odds are, you know, you have a friend or family member who works in sales, mention that to them, create like a human connection. I work in sales, so I'll often, while I'm doing the test drive, I'll start asking the car salesperson about what their commission structure looks like and like what their quotas look like. And they've always told me everything. They've never held back. And they've literally told, and that's, if somebody random just walked in and did that and was aggressive about it, I think they might hide more or they might lie. But because I was like, look, I'm in sales. Like, I know that I have to do it this way. How do you guys do the commission split if you work on this and this other guy? I was asking all these little questions. What I was trying to actually get at, and I don't know if they knew it, maybe I sales gamed them, maybe I sales strategied them. But by making that connection, I built some sort of trust there. And they told me like, yeah, you know, we have these daily quotas, and then we have weekly quotas, and we have monthly quotas. So then I was like, oh. In my head, I'm like, so if I show up at Thursday, 30 minutes before close on the 29th of the month, and you haven't hit your quota, you're going to be pretty hungry to sell me that car. Mm-hmm. You're going to make some concessions in order to do it. If I'm not eager, if I don't urgently need this car today, then I'm in a good negotiation sort of standpoint there. I'm in a good position and I have a little bit of extra information. So I think if you're on that receiving end, to be aware that that is still a human being, that is still their job. And they might, in those contexts, yeah, they might lie to you to try to get that sale, but that doesn't mean that you can't make a connection with them and be polite and try to get in with them and take things with a grain of salt, but learn as much as you can, even about their job, because then you can kind of use that against them. And it all's fair, right? In that situation, all's fair. So be aware of that. Be aware of those emotional things. Like I said at the beginning, you're not a guy who drives a Nissan. You're a guy who drives a Mercedes. You're totally, I can tell you're a Mercedes guy. They're trying to get you to picture it. It's like, dude, I'm in the dealership. Like, yeah, obviously I'm thinking about it. But they're trying to get you to really picture it so that, again, it creates that emotional connection to it. And that's explicitly manipulative. I would not personally feel super comfortable using those types of tactics myself in an offensive fashion, if you will. But yeah. To be aware of them helps it'll make it easier to defend yourself, hopefully.
That is so funny. I didn't realize that happened to me. That's a different conversation, but for sure we'll have to chat offline about funny sales tactics.
Yeah.
Are you down for answering just a few rapid fire questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So tell us one purchase that you've recently made that's made your life better.
Okay. I'm going to look around my apartment real quick before
I totally put you on the spot on this too.
Okay. So here's what, I've got one. I just bought an electric scooter. So okay. I live very close to my office and I live close to the San Francisco Bay Area. So it's when I get into the city, if I'm going to San Francisco or if I want to commute, I also have a car. Obviously we just talked a lot about cars, but, I now get to sort of save time and money by just having an electric scooter, and it is zero emissions, obviously. I mean, or close to zero. I guess you have to charge it, but it's just fun. It's an enjoyable way. I just enjoy the commute now, and it only doubles my commute from 5 to 10 minutes. So that's been a purchase that I think has been definitely net positive in terms of like life quality.
That is so cool. What's one location that you're dying to travel to?
Portugal.
Any part?
No, all of it.
It does look amazing. And then Ricky, from your perspective, what do you believe is the secret to financial success?
Be deliberate. I think you can't stumble your way into financial success. You have to think about it. You don't have to be an obsessive budgeter necessarily, but you have to at least be deliberate. Be aware of those things. Be deliberate about your strategies in terms of paying yourself first. If you know that you're the type of person who's going to have a hard time saving once that money hits your bank account, just making deliberate decisions that are consistent with what you know about your own psychology, your own emotionality. I think that's the key to ending up in the green. Even if you're not making that much money, even if you've got an unexpected expense, those are the kinds of things that will help shelter you from downside and keep you in the green.
I love it. Ricky, thank you so much for hanging out. Guys, if you want to go check out his podcast, The Wealthy Healthy Podcast, it's available pretty much everywhere. So just go look it up. It is amazing. I know I'm a big fan of it. Ricky, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for hanging.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun.
Okay, what'd you think? If you like this episode, make sure you share it with somebody that you think it could help and take notes. Go back through this one again. I know there was a lot of really good tactics and strategies that require a little bit of work. So it's really important that you take everything that Ricky shared into very high consideration and start to better your own life through this free info. So it was really cool that he shared all that stuff. I know I definitely learned a lot, especially the piece where Ricky talked about being more intentional with the words that you use and how you pose questions. That was really meaningful. So as a podcast host, it's something that I'm constantly working on, but it was always a good reminder to hear how we phrase questions matters, and the words that we use have a very large impact on people and the results that we get. So I thought that was really cool. If you have liked this episode, do me the biggest favor in the world. Stop, leave a review, and subscribe to the show. It means so much to me and truly helps this podcast get in front of more people. We are growing like crazy. So it's been really fun, and it's only because of you sharing, rating, and reviewing. That's the only reason this podcast gets in front of more people. So I'm super grateful for all of your work in helping me spread this message. Thank you so much for tuning in. I will see you next week for our 100th episode of the Money Nerds Podcast. Bye.